And an official welcome to Lincoln Square Synagogue for the fourth in of our series, What a Jew Believes, Practicing Faith in a Skeptical World. And I think, and I really am touched, even on a rainy Monday afternoon at 1 o'clock, so many people here to study together. The subject really gives me as a rabbi such tremendous encouragement to know that people want to be part of these important discussions and conversations. Just for a quick piece of housekeeping, a reminder, next Monday I'll be on my way to Johannesburg, so the last class, the fifth lecture, will be given at the beginning of March, and the daytime session will be on a Wednesday because of APAC policy conference. So the last daytime session will be Wednesday, the 4th of March, and not a Monday. So today's topic, arguably the most important of all, as far as Jews are concerned, or Jews in terms of Jewish observance, Torah from heaven. Did God really speak? And does he ever change his mind? This series started with a quote, an excerpt from a paper called Social Orthodoxy by Jay Lefkowitz, an individual who lives in the Upper East Side, who spoke about his frank skepticism about belief in God was one thing, but an idea that deity, a being, both cares and cares enough, cares what we do and cares enough to say, you shall wear woolen linen in your garments, you shall winnow your crops on the Sabbath day. Really, do I really believe in a God who legislates, who commands, who gave so many laws, so many commandments? Do I really believe, given everything that we now know about archaeology, about what biblical studies, documentary hypothesis, source criticism has brought to our understanding of Torah? Do I really believe that God commanded me to wear strings on the corner of my garment, etc., etc.? Alyssa has some spare handout sheets. So I want to say, again, and I don't mean these classes to be just performances of my own private beliefs, but yes, belief in the Torah, belief in revelation, is something that, again, stands the test of time. And in fact, one can make, again, we cannot talk about proof in the sense that would, sway a jury or make it into a reputable scientific journal. But the idea of finding more than enough to back up traditional claims, both historically and philosophically, of an idea of a God who cares enough to command is an extremely important undertaking. So let us begin. And I actually want to begin because the subject is really fraught with a tremendous amount of obscurity about what Jews actually believe. So I'm actually going to begin with the sense of what it is that traditional doctrine, if you like, has to say about these subjects. So the Torah, of course, commands, actually, in this week's Parsha, Alyssa has sheets. The Torah actually commands at the beginning, the Torah is given in this week's Parsha Yitro. And without consciously doing this at all, I actually realized that when we began at the end of Parsha Shemot, Parsha Va'era, with the existence of God, and we discussed on the following week, Parsha Bo, when the Jewish people come out of Egypt, in the about the eternity of the Jewish people, and last week, Parsha B'Shalach, when the Jewish people cry out to God at the Red Sea, we discussed prayer. And this week, Parsha Yitro, we're discussing revelation. That was in no means at all designed, but I guess proof for the evidence of God that these courses have indeed turned out to be so perfectly well synchronized with the Torah reading. But certainly this week's Parsha, the Torah makes a claim. The claim is that God revealed the laws, not just the Ten Commandments, but God's, on some level, descended onto Mount Sinai, spoke to the nation of Israel, Moses is an intermediate, and reveals and commands the Torah to the Jewish people. And the Torah itself is aware of the audacity of that claim, and we'll see in a moment why historically it is quite such an audacious claim. But we learn, for example, in Sefer Devarim, you might inquire about times long past, going back to the time God created man on earth, exploring from one end of the heavens to the other. See if anything as great as this has ever happened, or if the like has ever been heard. Has any nation ever heard God speaking out of fire as you have and still survived? The Bible, the Torah itself, describes, Moshe at the end of his life describes to the Jewish people this event, a nation hearing God address them all, is unheard of, never was, and never will be. And Maimonides, who famously formulated 13 principles of faith, the Yud Gimel Ikarim, actually has three. Two are here, one will leave for the end of the afternoon. But Maimonides says that there are a number of the 13 principles of faith are bound up with the question of revelation. The seventh principle, the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him. Now, these are excerpts from much longer pieces. Maimonides did not write Yigdal. The animami that we recite at the end of davening, many people recite, are indeed summaries of what the Rambam actually wrote in his commentary on the Mishnah. The seventh principle, the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, peace be on him, and that is that we believe that he was the father of all the prophets that were before him and that arose after him, meaning that all are below him in loftiness and that he is the chosen one from the entire human species. What Rambam is saying here in a convoluted way, but it becomes extremely important. The Torah is authoritative to the Jewish people in a way that nothing else will be authoritative. Moses was the greatest prophet the Jewish people had. We heard some commandments. Apparently, we were originally supposed to hear all 10 commandments directly from God. You'll read at the end of our parsha, the Jewish people were overwhelmed, they were scared. They apparently only heard 2 of the commandments directly from God. The rest are given through Moses. So our belief in revelation comes from the mass aspect of the revelation, but it also comes from both the reliability and the stature of Moshe. What that means is that there will be no prophets. It's an axiom of faith. There will never be, what do we say, Nigdal, Lokam b'Yisrael, k'moshe. There will never be a prophet as great as Moses who will be able to come along and say, what Moses told you, keep Shabbat, don't eat milk and meat. That was as high as his prophetic level went. I'm a greater prophet, and it turns out that you can. There will never be. The Torah is inexchangeable. It will not be annulled. And part of that is because no prophet will ever be on the level of Moshe, and everything that he said was ultimately authoritative. More importantly, the eighth principle, the Torah is from heaven, Torah mina shamayim. And that is what we believe, that this Torah that is given to us through Moses, our teacher, peace be upon him, is completely from the mouth of the Almighty, which is to say that it all came to him from God, may he be blessed, in a manner that is metaphorically called speech. God doesn't have, and Maimonides is extremely careful to avoid any kind of anthropomorphic implication that God speak, that God has a mouth. Therefore, God cannot actually speak. And therefore, the Rambam says it's a metaphor to say that God spoke. But nonetheless, the Torah, God communicated with Moshe. The words were transmitted to him. And no one knows how it came to him except Moses himself, peace be upon him, since it came to him. And we believe that he was like a scribe who is dictated to and writes down all his events, the stories, and the commandments. What the Rambam is saying is that it all came from Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, the Rambam himself, this discussion raises all sorts of interesting questions, that if we were to have more detailed class on this subject, we would want to know, the book of Genesis was written when exactly? Was it written by God and given to Moses? The Torah itself alludes to the existence of ancient, old books, Sefer Moshalim, Sefer Yashar. So did God write, re-record the stories of Genesis and give them to Moses at Mount Sinai? What about the book of Deuteronomy? It seems very clear that the book of Deuteronomy is something somewhat autobiographical. There are personal statements by Moses in them. And when were they given? Was the book of Deuteronomy given 40 years before it happened at Mount Sinai. So there's a lot of questions on a detailed level about exactly what and how the Torah was revealed. Was it revealed bit by bit? But the idea that Moses is saying, that the Rambam is saying, is that the entire Torah is divine, comes from Hashem to Moses, to the Jewish people. That is axiomatic. And therefore, Moses is called, over to the next page, Moses is called the engraver. And there is no difference. Bernie, do you mind just going and asking them to rough them up a little bit? And there's no difference between, and the sons of Ham were, now the Rambam here says, I want Bernie to miss this, the Rambam here says something extremely, extremely important. You cannot look, since every word of the Torah is divine, you cannot for a moment say that any part of the Torah is more important than everybody else. I know everybody's fascinated with Bernie's progress over there, but just stay with me for a second, because this is extremely important. The Rambam is saying there is no part of the Torah which is more important than any other part. And look what he says here, the top of page 2. And there's no difference between, and the sons of Ham were Cush and Mitzrayim, and his wife's name was Mechatabel. Timna was his concubine on the one hand, and I'm the Lord your God, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Shema Yisrael. If somebody asks you, what is the most important verse in the Torah? Shema Yisrael, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. You know the answer is, no such thing. The fact that Ishmael's, whoever it was, his concubine was called Timna, that's equally important, because every single word of the Torah is divine, since they are all from the mouth of the Almighty, and it is all from the Torah of God, complete, pure, and holy truth. And by the way, we know that. We know that because, what is the halakha if a Sefer Torah is missing a letter? Even if a letter is deformed or miswritten, what is the law? Sefer Torah is pasul. And it does not for a moment make a difference whether or not the missing letter is, quote-unquote, in an important part. You can't say, come on, we don't pay any attention to this verse anyway. This is an obscure verse. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change our understanding of the Torah. Part, in fact, this is not on the sheets. Part of the, if you like, the evidentiary case that is made to bolster our faith in Torah min Hashamayim is the extraordinary method that people have given to its accurate transmission. If a Sefer Torah falls to the floor, we fast. And if a Sefer Torah is missing even half a letter, it's pasul. It's not to be read. And anybody who's ever watched a Sefer Torah being written and know the extraordinary care that is made to make sure the Sefer Torah is copied with tremendous accuracy over thousands of years, copy mistakes will copyist errors will creep into any number of texts. It's a historical fact. A Torah that goes back thousands of years, it's not true to say there are no textual deviations at all. There are maybe a handful of different versions of writings of Sefer Torah from vastly disparate communities, from Yemenite communities and from Northern European communities. That itself, the minimal number of minor copy variations that have sneaked into a text that has been copied over thousands of years, is itself a fact, a testimony that the Jewish people have apparently always, always regarded this text as something of exceptional sanctity, whose transmission could only be done with extraordinary, with painstaking detail to accuracy. So let's go on. So how do we know? So this is our belief. These are our beliefs that the Torah was given, Mina Shamayim, every word of the Torah is divine, and it is not for us to ascribe any more authority to one part or the other. And as we'll discover, in no way whatever to try and think that the Torah is a temporary phenomena, that it applies in some times and not others. The Torah is given by the Almighty for all times and all ages. So what evidence can one bolster for that particular doctrine? As I said, this is not something which will necessarily pass the evidentiary bar in court or a scientific journal, but our faith is based on extraordinary principles. Now, we've already spoken before about our, proof for the existence of God. And certainly we spoke 2 weeks ago about the idea that the Jewish people still alive as foretold by the Torah. The Torah makes predictions, prophecies about the future that we ourselves are witness to. The constant near destruction but survival, and in our day and age, return to the Jewish people, to the land of Israel, of the Jewish people. The Torah is a book that makes predictions far into the future that we see in our own in our own day and age as coming true. Beyond that, there's a classic proof, quote unquote. When I say proof, I'm saying it in quotes. There's a classic proof for the veracity of the Torah tradition, which is that, and it's called the Kuzari principle. In contrast to other religions, where Abdil Muhammad has his encounters with God as a prophetic encounter, lonely, without anybody watching, and other encounters, Judaism stakes its claim on the fact that the entire Jewish people were witness to the events it describes. Both the exodus from Egypt, something that they experienced. So when God gathers the Jewish people in this week's Parsha and says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, the people there do not say, wait, what? We don't come from Egypt. We didn't live in Egypt. We live in Canaan. They don't say that. Torah addresses people, a mass population, not an elite. The Torah is not vouchsafed to a group of people. The Torah is revealed to the masses of people. And the people themselves hear God reveal the Torah to them. And the idea being, as Kuzari puts it, much of the Sefer Kuzari by the medieval philosopher Rabbi Yehuda Levi is based on this principle that a people could not get away with passing on such claims if they were false. A person can come along and say, God spoke to me in a dream, and I'll try and convince you whether he spoke to me or not. And then it's up to me to do magic, to do miracles, to convince you that God really spoke to me. When the Torah comes and claims God spoke to all of us, that's a different order of claim. People, at least in that first generation, and then who are going to be transmitting it down to next generations, can reliably say, no, we were there and this happened and we saw it. And therefore, the Kuzari says the faith of the Jewish people is based on eyewitness testimony and requires neither proof nor demonstration. Torah uniquely makes a claim that all the Jewish people stood at Har Sinai. Again, we saw that they didn't all hear God give every one of the commandments. They only heard God give all the beginning of the commandments. But they participated in an act of mass revelation. I actually have an acquaintance, he's a son-in-law of an old friend of mine from the UK, who's an up-and-coming Jewish philosopher. He's now at Haifa University. And he wrote a paper called The Kuzari Principle a number of years ago. And he says, strictly speaking, and I can see some of your faces, Kuzari Principle, the notion that a text thousands of years ago says that many, many people heard this, we wouldn't at face value nowadays, thousands of years later, take that as guaranteed, obvious proof. However, doing some philosophical if, then, but, prepositions, whatever, he derives the following nonetheless. And look at source number 4. And here Sam Liebens writes as follows. I contend that this revised Kuzari principle makes it rational to believe that the forebears of the Jewish people experienced a mass revelation of divinity and that there was a miraculous exodus from Egypt, even if the numbers involved were very much smaller than the biblical account. Okay, so without getting in the question, we'll see this later on. One of the questions of people who try and bring proof for the Torah description of events. There's two books that I'm going this afternoon or this evening to the Yeshiva University Sforim sale. There are two new books that are out just this year in English by Joshua Berman and by Amnon Bazak, both in one way or another deal with this question of archaeology and other evidence of the Torah, is that you can indeed bolster your belief in the giving of the Torah, but have to concede certain details, certain points. Could it be that this was exaggerated? So I don't want to get involved in any kind of nitty-gritty details. These questions have to be taken extremely, extremely finely. But what Sam Levin says is as follows, is that if you were to have a mass cultural myth that survived for millennia, you may come to question some of the details. But just, I mean, think about how archaeology works. If you were to uncover an inscription on a tomb somewhere in the middle of the, I don't know, the Iraqi desert, archaeologists would immediately assume that even if the details of the story were incorrect, without most probably, there was a kernel of truth that was being transmitted. So even, says Professor Levins, even if you consider your, you admit that the Khuzari proof does not necessarily prove that every detail happened in the way the Torah described it, the fact that the Torah tells this extraordinarily large and graphic story and relies on its transmission, again, not through this secret cadre of priests, but relies on every generation telling their children that this happened, then it is entirely reasonable to say that at the heart of this is a reporting of events that actually happened. In a different order of kind of proof or evidence, I remember years and years ago reading this. I've actually spoken now twice about my bar mitzvah chumash. In my day, art scroll hadn't been invented. So we had the Hertz chumash. Remember the Hertz chumash?
Yes.
The Pentateuchs and the Haftorahs. I gave it its full name. So I remember at some early point in my own Jewish self-education, leafing through the Hertz Chumash, and at the back of each Chumash, Rabbi Hertz has kind of little essays or extended comments. And I remember this actually challenged my memory, as I was delighted to find that after, I don't know how many decades, it was more or less I remembered it. But he reports the following phenomenon. This is source number 5 here on the sheets. The inconvenience of biblical traditions. This is bottom of page 2. He says, one or two examples will both explain this argument and make clear its unanswerable force. The first example is taken from the story of Abraham. For centuries, the Hebrew tribes waged a life and death struggle with the native population for the possession of ancient Palestine. I have to remember that those who claim, and Hertz is writing his Chumash in the 20s and 30s, specifically against the new school of biblical criticism, of biblical archaeology, that really maintains that scholarship proves that the Torah was a much later document, was written, emerged in Second Temple times, etc. So Rabbi Hertz makes the following point. Why would you make up a story that is quite so harming to your self-interest? If, as in those days they certainly were, as they've always been, the Jewish people are locked in a battle for possession of and security of their land, if you had to invent a national myth, what would you say? You'd say, we're from here. We come from here. We've always lived here. We were here before you. I've spoken many times about the fact that I had the somewhat questionable pleasure of sitting in the office of Saeed Erekat, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, in his office in Ramallah, and him telling a group of rabbis, we, the Palestinians, are the original Canaanites. We were here before you, and therefore we, the land, belongs to us and not you. The Torah tells us that the Jewish people, we didn't come from here, we came from somewhere else. Abraham, the founder of our nation, is a foreigner. He's a refugee, he's an immigrant. The Jewish people left the land of Israel in Egypt in order to come back to it. The Jewish people make a curiously undermining tale to justify their claim to the land of Israel. And the argument goes, that's a strange story. It's a self-defeating story to make up. And he has a number of examples as well. And he writes this fact that the Torah, in the ancient world, to be a slave and to be descendant of a slave, you know, yichus is considered to us, you know, like, you know, if the girl's got money, you know, that's the most important thing. If she has a little yichus as well, then we're definitely taking the shit. That's what people think yichus means. Her grandfather was a rabbi, definitely, you know, go on a date with her. That's in yichus and shidduchim. In the ancient world, Judaism as well, yichus, the notion of who you were descended from, whether you were low caste or high caste, is extremely important. The Torah tells a story over and over and over and over again and bids us to remember and never forget that we were slaves in Egypt. That's an extraordinary, radical idea, because it's basically telling a nation, you're not descended from the gods or demigods or the mighty ones. You're the lowest of the low. Again, that is a curiously self-defeating, undermining narrative for, certainly in what we understand of the ancient world, for any people to tell about themselves. So Rabbi Hertz says, instead of the Hebrews claiming that they too were natives of Canaan, that they were the true aborigines of its soil, biblical tradition concerning the beginnings of the Hebrew Bible is emphatic that his ancestors were not born in Canaan, but were nomads, immigrant shepherds, and had their origins in Ur of the Chaldees. Now, even the skeptical historian is forced to admit that such tradition must be based on strict history, as no people would invent such an inconvenient tradition in regard to a matter of vital importance, like its right and title to its national homeland. So that is what Rabbi Hertz writes, the inconvenience of biblical tradition. Of course, you could say, well, you see, that's exactly why they wrote the story that way, because that way, that's why you think that it must be true, because you wouldn't have told the story. Maybe that's just my Talmudic and suspicious mind getting ahead of me. But that is, I've always thought, a fascinating and interesting argument for evidence of the truth of the Bible. But let's go on, because I said before, we cannot prove that the Torah was given. We can believe it. And I firmly believe it. Our belief is rooted in tradition and the veneration, the experience we have of Torah, and many other factors we're going to talk about in a moment or two. We talk about the fact that the Bible is clearly a revolution. We fail to appreciate both how accurate it is in terms of its knowledge of the ancient world and how revolutionary a document it was. So we'll talk about, if you like, a modern case for belief in revelation. But let's just take a step back, because without being able to get involved in the nitty-gritty, can I prove to you that God gave the mitzvah of tefillin and tzitzit, etc., without getting involved in that, one can actually, very often, from a point of view of belief, there's a curiosity about revelation. I can believe that God created the universe. And we spoke 2 weeks ago about, 3 weeks ago, about these unseeing forces, a harmony, a logic of nature that just even the greatest contemporary scientists admit, embrace the idea that something stands and propels the universe into being, makes it inevitable and even makes life inevitable. That I get. The notion that a deity would talk. Nowadays, if somebody says, God spoke to me, you know, every rabbi has on his cell phone number. We had to actually had a whole course in shul yesterday for, you know, psychological mental health first aid. We would not regard that person as a religious authority. We would regard it as, somewhat a sign of a troubled soul who thinks that God speaks to them. So it seems ever so unlikely that God would tell people, communicate to them, not just in the specificity of it, but in the general idea of a God who will call you together and command. But looking at it from a different point of view, there are those who say, and I want to quote two, really both actually 20th century, technically 20th century, C.S. Lewis in the beginning of the Second World War and Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, that this argument itself, the God who communicates expectations, who reveals law to humanity, in fact makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. Let's take C.S. Lewis to begin with. C.S. Lewis, and I often quote around El Old Time, he was obviously the author of, wait, what did he write again? The Tales of Narnia. I often quote the Screwtape Letters. C.S. Lewis was part of the Oxford literati, friend of I was going to say J.K. Rowling. That couldn't have been J.R.L. Tolkien. And part of that, but C.S. Lewis converted to Christianity, was a skeptic, was born an atheist, or brought up as really a skeptic in Northern Ireland, embraced Christianity later on in life from a deeply held philosophical and spiritual quest. At the beginning of the Second World War, he gave a number of lectures on BBC radio, what would be called the home service in those days, that were later written up into a book called Mere Christianity. And he makes, and I alluded to this in the very first lecture that we had, he makes an argument for the moral, this argument, there's such a thing in the world of philosophy as called the argument from morality. Human beings know, in fact, the Torah assumes that even before it was given, humanity knows the basic difference between right and wrong. How do we know that? How do we know that to be cruel or indeed to kill or murder, steal is wrong? How do you know that? So philosophically, the idea is that since human beings have a sense that there is some way of being, that's a correct way of being, which is greater than their personal convenience or expediency, then, and this, by the way, is kind of the critique of this notion of theory of utilitarianism, that whatever delivers the mass amount of happiness to the most amount of people is the right thing to do. Not always. If a million people would be happy with the murder of 10 people, utilitarianly speaking, that might be a good outcome. From a moral, traditional moralist understanding, that's a terrible outcome. How do we know that? So the argument that human beings sense that there is some absolutes beyond their own lives, and that those absolutes are somewhere or other constant right across cultures, is an evidence that there is something greater than all of us. C.S. Lewis writes as follows, and we won't read this whole quote. He says, "Everyone." This is how he begins the essay or the lecture. "Everyone has heard people quarreling. Sometimes it sounds funny and sometimes it sounds merely unpleasant. But however it sounds, I believe we can learn something very important from listening to the kind of things they say. They say things like, 'How would you like it if anyone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first.'" He was at Lincoln Square sitting there. Yeah. Actually, Dove cannot. "Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first?" Now, he's actually writing this in the early years of the war when there's shortages and, you know, a lot of public impatience. "Give me a bit of your orange, I gave you a bit of mine. Come on, you promised." People say things like that every day. Educated people as well as uneducated, and children as well as grown-ups. Now, what interests me about all these remarks is that the man who makes them is not merely saying that the other man's behavior does not happen to please him. He is appealing to some kind of standard of behavior which he expects the other man to know about. And the other man very seldom replies, "To hell with your standards." Let me just finish this point here. These then are two points I wanted to make, says C.S. Lewis. First, and this is much later on, first that human beings all over the earth have this curious idea that they ought to behave in a certain way, and they cannot really get rid of it. Secondly, that they do not in fact behave in that way. They know the law of nature, they break it. These two facts are the foundation of all clear thinking about ourselves and the universe that we live in. And I just saw not that that quote in itself is sufficient by any means to understand the force of this argument, but the idea of this argument for morality, that people intuit and almost universally have a sense of fairness, of right and wrong. Richard Dawkins, who we've quoted before, the great atheist, skeptic, tries to show that there's some Darwinian social evolution, that human beings, organisms that are ultimately programmed for survival and self-advancement, have somehow, there's some evolutionary interest in moral behavior. No organism is safe if everybody's stealing each other's oranges. But, okay, I don't know how far you could push that argument. Certainly this argument that we intuit that the force behind the universe wants us to know, has indeed told us the difference between right and wrong, that itself is an important argument. That we intuit these ideas, that God does indeed, whether you can see it happening with 600,000 freed slaves at Mount Sinai. But the idea that a deity would want us to know what to do, sometimes in a very general way, and sometimes, as Jewish people stand for, in a very specific way, but the idea that God indeed would want desires of behavior to be known to his creatures is by no means a fanciful idea. Jonathan Sacks, and I mentioned last week that I was weaning myself off, this is the only Rabbi Sacks quote from the entire sheet today, but Rabbi Sacks has really a most beautiful and very compelling understanding of this idea, that God transmits knowledge of himself to the Jewish people through words, through speech, through law, that he talks to us and tells us what to do. And Rabbi Sacks says that fits in with the idea of God as the creator who is in communication. A God who wants a relationship, stands outside of creation, but nonetheless creates creatures who know him and are in communion with him. God reveals himself through words, through language, because it's on words and language that relationships are built. Without language, you have no way of processing meaning about anything. Look what Rabbi Sacks says here. And I think, again, this doesn't get involved in a notion, well, where do you see from that that God gave the mitzvah tzitzit and tefillin? It doesn't. But the idea that Judaism believes in a God who ultimately reveals himself through language, through words. What, this is source number 7, the bottom of page 3. What, therefore, is distinctive of Judaism is that God speaks and through speaking enters a dialogue with mankind. That is the first belief of Torah min haShamayim. Words are holy. Without words, there is no such thing as meaning. And that is why the soul in itself, the universe in itself, are not a place to find meaning. He says, I've often discovered that. I've tried occasionally to get involved in some kind of self-improvement and listen to classical music. You can listen to classical music, certainly if you are, I hope, intelligent, but not necessarily specifically instructed. You don't actually know what it means. Unless somebody's told you what the music, it might invoke within you a certain set of emotions. Similarly, you can look at a piece of abstract art. If the artist has explained what he's communicating, you can experience the art. Otherwise, you look at it, you don't quite know what to think. You can look at a beautiful sunset, but if you were created in a world, you might intuit that there must be something out there. You wouldn't also know. Nature itself doesn't tell a story of meaning. You might detect a echo of a being, of a creator, but nature and experiencing the world without words, without explanation, in no way helps people understand or frame the meaning of their lives, the purpose of their lives. You can live in a beautiful world and not still detect any purpose until that purpose is explained to you, until it's spelled out to you. Language is how we process everything. Once we have the language, you can then experience the art, the sunset, the music. This is what Rabbi Sacks said. It is only when we have words that we can give meaning to anything. We could not read meaning out of creation. The Gemara says that if the Torah had not been given, we would have learned industry from the ant, modesty from the cat. But the truth is that if the Torah had not been given, we could equally well have learned cunning from the fox, scavenging from a wolf, and violence from a tiger. The universe does not contain meanings on the face of it. That is because Judaism holds what is fundamentally holy is not a place, a person, or a power. What is fundamentally holy is words. God's speech to us and our response to God. Meanings lie in language. We would not find them anywhere else. That is why Judaism is a supreme example of religion of a religion of language and therefore of meaning. And Judaism therefore does not believe in icons. What is truly holy in Judaism? We don't have. What lies at the center of the Holy of Holies? Actually a book. The book, the written, the tablets of stone. There is no image of God. It is strict. There are no icons. In this shul, There are no pictures, no right. We're so meshuga, we even took off the eagle on top of the American flag since somebody thought that maybe we were worshiping the eagle, so we took it off. That's how devoted we are to this idea that God cannot be represented by anything physical, only represented by what is the most holy thing? The name of God. What is it we don't pronounce as the name of God? It is speech in Judaism, which is the ultimate holy thing. We would not find them anywhere else. That's why the famous interpretation of Mashiach Chachma, Moses smashed the tablets of stone to show that even the tablets of stone, if God, if you've abandoned God and God has abandoned you, even the tablets of stone are not holy. Nothing is holy except the word, the speech of God. We would not find them anywhere else. That is why Judaism is a religion of language and therefore of meaning. If we do not find God in the Torah, we will not find him anywhere else. And I think that this argument, by the way, again, without necessarily getting involved in the specificity of all the books, the book of Numbers, the book of Vayikra, sacrifices, the idea that rather than being surprised about a God who spoke and communicated, you would be amazed at a God who did not reveal himself, reveal his thoughts, his instructions, his directions to his creation. And as we saw 2 weeks ago, the Jewish people are chosen to be that beacon, that precise moment of coming out of Egypt, the slave nation emancipated, given this great hope for humanity. Precisely at that moment, the Jewish people are given Torah to transmit to humanity. That is a theological, on the one hand, it's an axiom, it can't necessarily be proven in a historical sense, but the idea that it would be illogical, Rabbi Sacks says, is itself illogical. How else would God indeed communicate his knowledge, the knowledge of him and his desires to people, other than through revealing himself in words and speech? Yes, Bernie. Only because I want my voice to have a break, and you bravely squared off to the security guys.
Flat. In Rabbi Sacks' last sentence, does the we refer to Jewish people or to the men of the world?
Yeah, I
guess to... Yeah, well, so that's a question about whether or not does the Torah speak only to humanity, does God communicate? Yeah, I think both. I think the Jewish idea is that through the Torah, human beings, as we saw a couple of weeks ago, humanity also derives tremendous moral lessons and benefits. And in fact, that is a perfect segue to part 3. So turn over to page 4. And because I want to keep very much to our time today, I want to summarize ideas that I have spoken about in the past. I have a very dear friend who is an Orthodox rabbi and a real Talmud Chacham. He originally started off his learning career at a part of a different denomination and eventually settled in Orthodoxy. And I once asked him what convinced him to switch and really embrace Orthodox Judaism. And he told me that he had, while studying at the seminary he'd been at, he studied the works of an individual who, actually, I don't know what his own personal standards of observance may be, and he may have been fully ritually observant, Professor Nachum Sarna. Professor Nachum Sarna, who is a Bible professor at Brandeis University, considered a great, great, great figure in Jewish biblical archaeology, biblical scholarship, was one of the first people to point out what is now a burgeoning theme. In fact, one of the books that I intend to purchase tonight at the Sforian sale is by Professor Joshua Berman of Bar-Ilan University. It's considerably developed this idea that however skeptical you and I might be about a God who summons a group of slaves at Mount Sinai and starts telling them very detailed laws about if you have an ox and it gores, it attacks your neighbor's ox, then you have to pay 30 pieces of silver, unless it's a Tuesday, in which case, there's senior citizens, this guy, you know, like the incredible specificity and the almost sort of random nature. The one minute the Torah is speaking about these lofty ideas, and the next minute it's talking about most mundane ideas. What's all that about? So Professor Sarna pointed out that, and then a real blow came to many people's belief. And this is why what motivated works, early 20th century works like the Hertz Chumash, when they dug up and they decoded texts like the Hammurabi Code and others. Because it turns out the Hammurabi Code was way before the Torah was given, dated. And the Epic of Gilgamesh, if you find out that there's in fact a flood story in the ancient Babylonian rituals, and that there are ancient law codes that predate the Torah by many, many centuries that are also full of rules about if your slave's ox attacks your neighbor's donkey, then you'll pay this and you'll pay that. So that, to many people, was a tremendous blow to their religious faith. Turns out the Torah is not unique. It was just copied from other legal systems. They cut and paste other books together. Makes sense that a slave nation would look for some kind of constitution. That's what they did. Fascinating thing, just as an aside, by the way, at the time that it's alleged by biblical critics that the Torah was written, in other words, not contemporary, but many, many centuries later, humanity would have no idea, nobody living in Palestine in the 5th century BCE would have ever heard of the Hammurabi Code. They wouldn't be able to read the Hammurabi Code. But leaving that aside, here's the critical point. Many people threw up their hands in shock and said the Torah is just a Near Eastern covenantal religion like any other. Nachum Sarna and others asked bigger questions. Specifically, they said, what are the legal assumptions of this text? Are they exactly the same? Are they different? They certainly sound the same. So look at next week's Parsha Mishpatim. Slaves and donkey and oxen and pits and fires and restitution and tort, etc. But when you go beyond that, and you start saying, what are the moral assumptions of these laws versus those laws? What message, what society are they describing? What are the outcomes of those laws? Then you see something amazing. And that what happened is that, and this is not evolutionary, you cannot see a gradual development. First there's the Elamish code, and then there's Hammurabi, and then there's this, and then there's that, until finally you get to the Torah, and you see certain ideas have gradually evolved. You don't see that. The Torah introduces, through the rubric of laws that would have been familiar to people alive at the time, introduces an absolute disruption of morality. Suddenly new laws are being taught. They sound like the same. The laws are substantially familiar, but the morality of the laws are unprecedented. Turn over to page 5, and we'll just do basis. Now, before we read this, I just point out, and we've mentioned this a number of times, the Torah reveals to humanity any number of new ideas that weren't extant before. Shabbat, the idea of a day of rest, is an original Jewish idea that emerges into the world with Judaism. The notion, for example, that all life is sacred. Ancient Greeks, Aristotle writes about the fact that if you have a weak or sick or injured or disabled, deformed child, the correct thing to do is expose it or drown it so that it doesn't be a burden on anybody. The notion that all life is sacred, again, is not a classical idea. It's not an ancient Greek or ancient Roman idea. It's a Jewish idea. It emerges through the Torah, through the narratives of Bereshit and through Torah legislation. But even in the level of specificity, this is a professor called Jeremiah Unterman. And look at page 5, and we'll just read this one source to kind of adequately deal with this argument that I must admit I find extremely persuasive. Alone in the ancient Near East, in biblical law, human life and property are not commensurable. No way exists to legally equate them or to measure one against the other. In all of the ancient law codes of Mesopotamia and others that predate the Torah, the idea that a wealthy person can both have different laws and different standards of laws applied to them, but also buy their way out of trouble of capital punishment by either substituting a slave or paying their way out was in many societies a given. The Torah, when we look at these laws, Torah achat yelachem, there should be one law wherever you are, rich or poor, we look at that law and say, why is the Torah just, those words don't mean it, that's just like background noise. No, it's not background noise. This is a radical idea that comes into the world at Mount Sinai. It's an astonishingly important idea. The standard in biblical law is that human life cannot be substituted for vicariously or ransomed. No economic value can be applied to human life. Only the person who's guilty can be executed. We look at those lines and say, duh, obvious. But the same token, no civil property damage or theft can be compensated for by human life. Property must be compensated by property and life by the life of the guilty person. What lies behind this diametrically opposed perception of human value? As we have seen, Emunah Elish, the Babylonian creation epic that was recited annually, has a very explicit understanding of human value. This epic explains that the purpose of the creation of humans was to be the gods' slaves, thereby enabling the god to rest from the drudgery of serving themselves. Humans fill the gods' needs for food, drink, and shelter by providing sacrifices, libations, and temples. In other words, in ancient Babylonian myth, humanity is created as a slave of the gods. Human life worth is therefore meaningless. In other words, the humans have utilitarian purpose. They're created not for their own sake, but as a means to an end, a tool to be used by the gods for their own relaxation. It is not too great a jump to go from the view of all humans as a god's slave to that of a single human life as having limited value. In light of Emunah Elish, the perspective of both the biblical creation story and the flood story presents a revolution in evaluating human life. As already mentioned, Genesis 1 reveals a totally novel, majestic view of humans, made in the divine image and given the world to rule. God creates humanity, but Tselem Elohim, in his likeness, and tells humanity, this world is for you, pru rvu, milu et haaretz v'kiv shua. Subdue the world, enjoy it. Of all the trees of the garden I've given to you, to enjoy. That is a biblical creation story of a God who out of love creates creatures to enjoy a world made for them. And that idea, every human being is created in the image of God and is therefore extraordinarily valuable. And no, in the famous words of the Mishnah, why does the Torah tell us the story of the creation of one human being, of Adam, so that nobody can say to another person, my ancestor is more important than your ancestor. It's an extraordinary radical idea. We take it for granted. Western civilization takes this idea for granted because we have the Hebrew Bible. If we didn't have it, we wouldn't think that way. As already mentioned, in God's address to Noah and his children, the end of the flood story imparts a new legal repercussion of being created in God's image, the idea that you're not allowed to shed blood. And look actually very quickly at, let's just go back actually, source number 10, Paul Johnson, History of the Jews, a famous and very popular book when it came out, I guess, in the 1980s. And he writes, certainly the world without the Jews would have been a radically different place. And he doesn't mean that because nowadays we're inventing Bluetooth technology or, you know, theory of relativity. He's talking about the ideas that Jews brought onto the world stage. Humanity might eventually stumble upon all these Jewish insights, but we cannot be sure. All the great conceptual discoveries of the human intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they have been revealed, but requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time. The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human, of the sanctity of life and the dignity of human person. When, you know, right now it's in the news a little bit, when the Supreme Court or other buildings are built in this sort of classical, neoclassical style to emphasize, you know, perfect proportions and pillars and, you know, kind of Greek temples of enlightenment, it's easy to think that the ideas that are the bedrock of our democracy come from the classical world of Greece and Rome, but they don't. They don't. They come from a desert nation standing at the mountain, having these words revealed to him. The dignity of human person, the individual conscience, and so personal redemption of collective consciousness, and so social responsibility. Of peace as an abstract ideal, and love as a foundation of justice, and many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind. Without Jews, it might have been a much emptier place. So, and just one more word on this, because in along this school of biblical archaeology, once you begin looking at this, it becomes so very fascinating. Because the idea of a covenant, as many people and many archaeologists have pointed out, the giving of the Torah in this week's Parsha fulfills many of the descriptive elements of the way that a conquering king would make a treaty with the tablets of stone, or two stones, one for each side, would make a treaty with a conquered vassal people. But what's fascinating is that God does not make a treaty with Moses. In the ancient world, when a powerful king was victorious over a lesser king, the two kings would make a vassal kind of treaty. God makes a covenant with every Jew. Every Jew is responsible for the covenant. Every Jew enters the covenant. Every Jew is responsible for keeping the mitzvot and for passing them on to the next generation. In the Jewish formulation of what a covenant with God is, it is that every Jew, if you like, is a king who is summoned to pay homage to a more powerful king. It is not the nation of Israel. It is every individual Israelite who is part of this tremendous covenant. Let's say, and time isn't on our side, and I want to make sure both to finish this and finish this with my voice still intact. Let me just shed light on something extremely interesting that is happening again in our world. Because in terms of current scholarship, now in the university, academia, I know that many, many, many people, and most biblical studies departments, will disagree with what I'm about to say. There has been a tremendous amount of intellectual productivity on behalf of believing Jews in the last two or three decades to substantially change the conversation around the veracity or the authenticity of the Torah. In the late 19th centuries, Wellhausen and other people developed theories of biblical criticism. Apparently one of the first people to mention it, that the idea of biblical criticism is if you look at the Torah, you sometimes see contradictions. If you look at the story of the spies in the book of Numbers, you'll see that God told Moses to send spies to spy the land of Israel. If you look at the same story as reported at the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy, you'll see that God says, Moses, you came up with this idea to send spies, and I decided to let you do it. That's a flat-out contradiction. So first of all, Chazal, the sages, were aware of apparently contradictory passages. Spinoza felt that this was really a proof that the Bible wasn't divine because it contains contradictory narratives. Sometimes God is called Elohim and sometimes he's called Hashem. And the more you look for it, the more you can see, in fact, the hand of many authors and many fragments. And the documentary hypothesis is not just that different books were written by different people, but that there are layers of that the Torah, in fact, is stitched together by multiple documents, for all sorts of reasons. And a bit like the tailor we used to use, wasn't that skilled at hiding where the stitches and the alterations were. So it was a little sloppy sometimes. The great redactor wasn't that great a redactor. He left too much of his handiwork showing. And that really is something which became the orthodoxy, and still is to a large extent, of biblical studies departments. Jonathan Sacks, in a separate essay, points out why Christians would have less of a problem, wouldn't have their faith challenged in the way that Jews would, because as he pointed out, Jews regard the text as the ultimate vehicle of the revelation of God. Christians believe the body of Jesus is the revelation of God. The text is somehow or other secondary. For Jews, the text of God is the revelation. If that is shown to be a shoddy patching together of different traditions, the whole story goes out of the window. So in the last decades, there has been tremendously interesting work being done to reestablish the authenticity of the Torah text. One is, as archaeology and our knowledge of the ancient world has progressed, is the idea that the Torah is accurate in ways that wasn't considered to be before, and again, wouldn't have been known about. As I mentioned before, Jews living in the time that the codes of J and P and E were supposed to be writing in the days of Ezra would not have known about the Hammurabi Code and wouldn't have been able to read the Hammurabi Code. So therefore, it doesn't make sense to ascribe to the Torah much later authorship, because now, incredibly specific, Professor Joshua Berman wrote an incredible essay showing how Shirat Hayam, which we learned last week in Shul, has incredible literary parallels with the recently discovered Egyptian war poetry. Ezra wouldn't have known that. Only people living at the time would have known what they were doing, but oh, I see what he did there, channeling familiar texts and recasting them in a divine way. Moreover, just one example, it used to be thought, the Torah says, regarding the laws of Maaser Sheni, that when you have produce that you cannot eat in Jerusalem, that you're supposed to eat in Jerusalem, you're supposed to redeem their value onto a coin, onto a tsura, a coin with an image. Biblical critics used to say, duh, everybody knows that coinage wasn't invented until many, many, many centuries later, until it turned out that indeed it was. They used to say the ancient Egyptians at the time of the story of Egypt didn't have horses. Horses weren't known outside of Arabia until much later on. It's an anachronism, again, until it turned out that indeed they did have horses. Many, many examples. And that's as far as biblical archaeology is concerned. But there's a more fundamental point, which I want to cut on quickly, which is there might be a different reason where the Torah apparently tells two stories, or the same story, in an apparently contradictory way. And that's to do really with what we might call reportage. A literary insight that one story can never adequately or fully explain the events of a story. After all, Jewish law, if you want to commit try a case, how many witnesses do you need? Two. Why? Because you can never adequately understand an event from one perspective. Paradoxically, even though he wasn't deliberately trying to answer biblical criticism, one of the most famous examples of this alternative understanding to biblical criticism is actually by Rabbi Soloveitchik. What famous contradictory story does Rabbi Soloveitchik recast? Anybody? How many accounts of the creation of Adam are there in the Bible? Famously two. Genesis 1 tells the story of Adam who's created alone. Genesis 2 tells us about Adam and Eve. And Genesis 1 tells us of one Adam split into two. And many other differences in the story, the emphasis that leads a comparison there to the story of the creation of Adam is told twice, in Genesis chapter 1 and Genesis chapter 2, with very many differences. Rabbi Soloveitchik actually writes, and look here at the bottom of page 5, and then we'll really kind of wrap this up a little bit. Rabbi Soloveitchik says, I have never been seriously troubled by the problem of the biblical doctrine of creation vis-a-vis the scientific story of evolution of both the cosmic and the organic levels, nor have I been perturbed by the confrontation of the mechanistic interpretation of the human mind with the biblical spiritual concept of man. And then he goes on to talk on the next page about, I've never been bothered about apparently contradictory stories. Look at the last four lines of this chapter, of this source number 12. This incongruity was not discovered by the biblical critics. Our sages of old were aware of it. However, the answer lies, in other words, how will a biblical critic, a documentary hypothesis academic, explain the divergent traditions of creation of man in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2? Two authors. What kind of sloppy redactor Well, that's the gig economy for you. You know, you just can't get the staff. He didn't think to tidy up the position well enough, or different constituencies wanted their story included in the final draft. The Torah was a book written by committee. Rabbi Soloveitchik says we're not having any of that. The answer lies not in an alleged dual tradition, but in dual man. Not in an imaginary contradiction between the two versions, but in a real contradiction in the nature of man. And in his famous essay, The Lonely Man of Faith, Rabbi Soloveitchik explains how the Adam 1 and Adam 2 tell two stories, both true about humanity. Humans are both subservient, obedient creatures of God and proud, brave creators. We're both brave and scared. We are both this and that. The Torah can only adequately do justice to the basic fundamental question of what is mankind by telling us two stories. At first glance, contradictory, but when read together, phenomenally rich and nuanced and complex. And there's a whole school. I go every summer in Israel to the days of study of Tanakh. There are entire schools. Professor Jonathan Grossman, who's spoken in our shul many, many times. Rabbi Amnon Bazak, whose book I have an excerpt of Chaim Angel's book review of a book called Adayom Hazeh, Until This Day, Fundamental Questions in Biblical Teaching. This book by Rabbi Amnon Bazak has just been translated to English. It's just available for sale this week. And again, deals with this question. It shows that how many of the questions of the biblical critics ask against the Torah, both from the perception of archaeology, but also from the reliability of the text itself, the apparent contradictory nature of the text, can indeed be answered in very, very different ways. And I'm just going to say one word about the question of does God change his mind? But we really are out of time, and we'll just have to have a separate class on this. But the argument that I want to make is as follows. Let me just say the following. Does God change his mind? On the one hand, of course not. The mitzvahs are eternal. God gave the Torah and applies in every generation. No generation is able to say, and this indeed is what's commanded the loyalty, the fealty of Jews, that we do not say that was for then, this is for now. So God doesn't change his mind. Lo yachalif hakel velo yamir dato. He's not about to rescind any mitzvah. You can pray as hard as you like, but if your Super Bowl World Series is on a Shabbos after, could that even be? It's still going to be Shabbos no matter how hard you pray. It's not changing anytime soon. It's not changing ever. However, it's a fascinating discussion. The times of the Messiah, will there be sacrifices when the Messiah comes and Torah law is reinstituted? It's actually a surprisingly fascinating question about whether or not we're going to have slavery again, we're going to have all of these laws of the Torah. So that, in fact, is extraordinarily nuanced discussion about the interaction between human morals and Torah values. What's fascinating, however, is that despite and possibly because of our extreme adherence to revelation and Torah min haShamayim, we also know that God spoke but doesn't continue to speak. And that a Torah, no matter how many words it contains, cannot tell you what to do when the electronic lights in your stairwell or the front door of your building is electronic. And then what are you supposed to do? So there's the written Torah, and there's the oral Torah, and there's the power of interpretation. A Torah that was just words on a scroll would not be a living Torah. Along with the Torah comes the power and the duty to apply and to interpret. And that, of course, not just rabbinic law, the rabbis had the powers to invent new laws, to preserve the laws, to extend the laws, but in a formulation that Rabbanit Henkin, who is the inventor of the Yoetzet Halakha program, which I'm a huge supporter of, and mentioned when she came to our shul many, many years ago, Halakha does not change. Doesn't change. Psak Halakha, which is the legal ruling of any one day, can change. Can change in circumstances. Shabbos will always be Shabbos. Whether we'll understand the laws of electricity the way that rabbis 100 years ago understood them, or new insights, again, not an attempt to reform Judaism, say this doesn't apply, but whether through conscience, this is why the Jewish people, why constant mass high-level Torah study is so important, because these things can never be arbitrary. It only comes from the deepest understanding, from people who have the entire Torah at their fingertips. People who have the deepest level of Torah knowledge and understanding can, in consultation with others, in other words, in a consensus of such figures, arrive at new understandings of Torah and ways of applying these laws to new situations. So mitzvahs will never be rescinded. Halakha is never going to be less than a fully authoritative. But there is an astonishing ability that we have to make Torah relevant in every generation. In every generation. I once had a conversation with the head of the British government, appointed a watchdog to look after fertility treatments and human genome and genetics and cloning when these technologies were being rolled out. And I had a conversation with a person, she was a Jewish lady, secular Jewish lady named Ruth Deitch, now Baroness Deitch. She came to Cambridge to speak one Friday night to the Jewish society. And she said to me, Rabbi, obviously there's nothing in the Torah about any of this, because I deal with, you know, DNA and cloning and gene transplant, and, you know, and there's nothing in the Torah that deals with these. So I said to her, you know, the Talmud discusses what happens if the Talmud could not understand how it could happen, but discusses a theoretical possibility. What if the ubar, the fetus of a cow, was transplanted from one cow to another? If a weasel took the fetus from one cow, transplanted into the other, which cow, and the first cow had already had children, the second one hadn't, is the fetus born? Is it considered a firstborn or not? The Talmud wasn't talking about scientific knowledge, but it was talking about what would happen if. And those questions become the basis for extraordinarily sophisticated understanding of modern technology. So the Torah finds itself infinitely, and maybe this is the greatest proof of all for Torah Min Shabayim, that a text given thousands of years ago, literally chiseled in stone, is still relevant. It still has answers for and has applicability and guidance for every moral and technological question that still comes up. The Torah makes a claim that it will never fall into redundancy. We live modern lives here in this shul, in this neighborhood. We live fully modern lives, and we're able to do that because of and in obedience to the Torah. Maybe that is the greatest proof of any, that the Torah really is a divine, living, godly given document. Thank you so much for your attention. And miraculously, my voice survived.